What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Many of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, which is my effort to find the most interesting people in the world and sit with them for hours while I ask questions in an effort to learn. So it would mean the world to me if you would subscribe to the show on your favorite audio platform, watch episodes on YouTube, and tell your friends and family about the podcast. My goal is to help millions learn from the world's most interesting people. So let's get into today's episode. Today's episode is with Greg Beard. He's the CEO of Stronghold Digital Mining. In this conversation, we talk about the macro situation for both Bitcoin and the US dollar, and why Greg has a unique view as to all of the doomsayers may not be correct, but there still could be structural problems. We also talk about Bitcoin mining, the effects of that incoming halving, the role of miners in the market, how the Bitcoin ETF and BlackRock's success may actually be something to be worried about, and why he sees tokenization being able to pull back some of the spotlight from artificial intelligence back into the Bitcoin and crypto world. Greg is a well-read, very interesting person, and today he shares tons of insights that I think that you will find very informative. I enjoyed talking to him, and I'm excited to hear what you all think. Here is my conversation with Greg Beard.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Today's episode is brought to you by Proppy. Imagine a world where you could buy and sell your home wallet to wallet. With Prop Keys, you can mint your home address and upgrade it to a real-world asset. This not only protects your home's title from fraud, but when you are ready to move, you can sell it through an NFT auction as well as through the traditional way. There's optionality here. Proppy Keys is part of the Proppy ecosystem. Their mission is to make home ownership more efficient, affordable, and user-friendly. Proppy Keys is a fun entry point to placing title on the blockchain. Now, anyone can start their on-chain journey by minting home addresses via Proppy Keys and staking them for profit until they are ready to sell their home. Visit ProppyKeys.com to learn more. Again, that's ProppyKeys.com to learn more. Today's episode is brought to you by Supra. If you're building anything in Web3 or crypto, you likely need oracles and verifiable randomness too. Supra's offering the fastest oracles and DVRF free for 12 months at Supra.com/pomp for a limited time. Supra delivers the freshest Oracle price feeds across 50 plus blockchains, critical price levels, or liquidation triggers. Beat your competition to the punch with Supra. It's as good as having the first mover advantage on every price update. Supra is more secure, easier to integrate, and runs on up to 12x lower gas per feed than other Oracles. So you'll want to bank on this 12 months free offer as soon as possible. If you're just listening and know any builders, you can earn $1,500 by letting them know about this deal. They can get the fastest oracles for free for 12 months, and you get $1,500 for every referral. Visit supra.com/pomp to learn more. That's supra.com/pomp. All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Greg here with me. Greg, you've got some very nuanced and unique thoughts when it comes to the macro environment. Most people in Bitcoin and even in the gold world, you know, the world is ending. Go buy your asset today and prepare for hell tomorrow. Maybe it's not that simple. And so help us walk through, like, how do you evaluate the macro economy and specifically through the lens of people who are holding Bitcoin?
Yeah, so that's a big part of the Bitcoin narrative is it's protection from the debasement of the dollar. And that's absolutely true, but that's a generational story. So, you know, when you do the math, and I've got, you know, thank Christian on my team to put all of this together for me today. But hey, right now we've got like $34 trillion in debt. That number has doubled since Bitcoin was invented, you know, in 2008. We are running a deficit of $1 to $2 trillion a year now. And like, even so, that we're on the top 10 list of the most levered countries. Like the next one up is number 9, Italy. You know, Greece is on that list, Venezuela, Sudan. It's not a list of heroes. We just got downgraded, you know, by Fitch, our current dollar, you know, government from AAA down to AA. So it's sort of, it's happening. But even so, over the next 10 years, our debt's projected to only go to $50 trillion. Our economy is going to grow to mid $40 trillion. Government receipts will still be there. So we're not, like, the currency isn't in trouble. So this isn't a rush to Bitcoin in a panic. But make no mistake, we have a long-term problem, but it's going to take a generation or two for that to play out. So, and how does that play out? Well, hey, there'll come a day where the government will go and try to sell bonds in the auction, and they won't sell, or they'll have to go back and you know, sell for a higher interest rate. So, like, the cracks in the foundation is, you know, represent themselves as, hey, right now we're taking, our government takes in around, you know, $4.5 trillion a year, and interest is more than $1 billion, or $1 trillion rather, big numbers. So it's not I'll still plead with our government, do not deficit spend. You know, I'm 52. We've had about 4 years in my lifetime when we haven't. Or at least, if you can't do that, make sure that the economy is growing more quickly than the debt is growing. So that is the way out of the mess is fiscal responsibility. But I think, just given the political messes that we live in, you know, it doesn't seem probable. Like, a Joe Biden is not going to be alive when the U.S. debt crisis hits. So, hey, he's incentivized to keep spending. It's not going to impact him. I'm 52, as I said. Probably in my lifetime, we'll have a crisis. All of this, these deficit spends will cause a crisis. But I think if you're interested in Bitcoin, hey, that's a long-term, you know, what I would describe as a generational issue. And it's happening. But I think the Bitcoin story works better for countries that are even less responsible than the U.S. You know, like, I was in Egypt over the Christmas break. They're suffering with 35% inflation. And I think they're more of the norm. So I think, in a way, while, yes, the U.S. is failing, you know, our all the citizens by deficit spending, hey, we're sort of, and we're on the top 10 list of most levered, right? So we're not looking great, but it's not a crisis yet like it is elsewhere. So it's but I think, hey, what's driving, like, the Bitcoin price? So I think everyone you have on your show talks about, like, the macro and the debasement of the currency. And that's true, but hey, this is going to take a long time to play out, like decades and decades to play out before we have a crisis related to debasement.
When you wake up every morning, what are the things that you look at, either metrics or trends in the traditional financial system? So not Bitcoin or mining related, but, like, what are the things that you kind of check to see, hey, how are we doing today? And are things getting better or worse?
Yeah. So the things that are pushed on us are, hey, where is the stock market futures that up or down? Are we going to have an up or day down? You know, what's pushed on us is, what is the Fed doing? Will the Fed ease, you know, and we all know the narrative. Hey, we had them, you know, which they tend to do. We had multiple, you know, what, 7 raises, and quickly, you know, try to tamper down inflation. And actually, when you look back at Fed behavior, that's how they normally do it. You know, they don't go 25 basis points and wait a year to go another. They hit you pretty hard. And that's so they behave like they normally do, if you looked at past Fed actions. So now you're saying, hey, the what we're being pushed on us is, what will the Fed do? When will they ease? And obviously then look at inflation data that will then inform, you know, all of the pundits for what the Fed is likely to do. I'm running a Bitcoin mining business, so I can't help it but to look at Bitcoin, look at hash price. That's what most impacts my day-to-day business.
And when you begin to think about kind of this macro environment, we sitting in the United States tend to think of the U.S. economic situation. How much do you think the international markets, or specific countries internationally where, you know, currencies are being debased at a faster rate, there's inflation rates that are measured in, you know, kind of high 2 or even 3 figures, how much of it is a, you know, U.S. story versus maybe a internationally, this is a common problem that people are facing, and some are dealing with it better versus others?
You know, I think the best way to answer that is to say that, hey, we're still really in the early days of Bitcoin adoption and use, and just the utility of Bitcoin today is it's more, has more utility in countries that are debasing their currencies, that are suffering with high inflation. But the quantum of dollars in our retirement system, and I'll go to an example of like of what I think the impact of the ETFs is likely to be, or BlackRock is likely to be on Bitcoin price. But I would describe, hey, there are a myriad of issues that I would say are kind of ripples in, on the water, including, yeah, countries like Egypt or, you know, Nigeria, or pretty much, you know, the list is long. Most countries have no choice but to print more than they take in. But that's ripples on the water versus the wave of U.S. ETF money potential, the wave of U.S. retirement savings potential, and still just the relative scarcity of Bitcoin. So like my example there is sort of, I guess, going, hey, what will Bitcoin price do? And like my answer to that is, you know, as I said, just a long wait to wait for the dollar to crash. We don't want it to crash anyway. It's not good for Bitcoin, not good for the world if the dollar doesn't do well. So I can say Bitcoin can do well even if the dollar does well. But in the short run, the wave is really related to BlackRock. So they've got $17 billion now in their ETF. It's only three months old. We're about to have the halving, and the halving means we'll only be making, as an industry, 450 coins per day. And that is the supply. So this is there's a bunch of noise. At the end of the day, this is a supply demand problem. We're capped at 21 million coins, and we're only supplying 450 new ones a day. If BlackRock next month, they go from 17 billion to 18 billion, that is more than 500 coins a day of additional demand from BlackRock alone. So from what I've heard, and the way I would behave if I were them, is to be very measured. It's like, hey, they are going to end up with the biggest Bitcoin ETF. Grayscale is shrinking. BlackRock is growing. So they can rest easy knowing they have the market. They're managing almost 10 trillion. The size of their ETF growth should be measured, meaning they shouldn't go out to all their clients and have a big push to try to create, you know, 10 billion in a month of additional demand. There isn't the supply. You know, we only see less than 2 million coins now trade on exchanges. I just don't know. The coins aren't available, right? So they're going to, if they were to do that, they would by themselves cause a price bubble, hurt their own clients, probably have egg on the face with the regulator that let the ETF through after almost, 10 years. And so if you think about Bitcoin price in the short run, the wave is ETF capital and how these guys behave in terms of controlling the spigot of demand, because the supply is fixed and known.
What do you think are the downsides if BlackRock, kind of didn't slow play this? And slow play sounds hilarious when you say it's a 3-month fund with, $17 billion in it. But in terms of, maybe let's just talk about, you're an asset management firm. There's people knocking on the door. Obviously, you probably can slow play how much outbound sales and marketing and stuff you're doing. But like, what are the downsides if everyone just says, screw it, I want as many assets as possible, and like, let's go?
Yeah, I think because there isn't the supply of Bitcoin isn't there, and those that have it, those that have it trading on exchanges, that's obviously more liquid. If you add a lot of additional demand, you're going to see like really outsized upward price movement that then create the potential for a bubble. And I think bubbles are bad, in any industry, and the implication would be, It could lead to additional regulation. If a bubble is burst, you'll have then, the investigations like, hey, what happened? Why did Bitcoin go to, 500,000 a coin, then retreat back to 100,000 a coin? You'll have a bunch of unhappy investors that participated in that. A fresh regulatory look. It's just it's a bad idea to create a demand-related bubble if you can avoid it, right? And of course you have, BlackRock isn't the only ETF. Like many others are scrambling and doing their best to create demand on their platforms. But it is tough to compete with the largest asset manager in the world.
So let's talk about miners, obviously the business that you guys are in on a day-to-day basis, and you probably think maybe the most about. There's some similarities to what the asset managers have to think about. Like that cut from 900 Bitcoin a day to 450 doesn't just affect the asset managers, doesn't just affect the investors. It also affects you all. And so how do you think today about kind of where miners are and what is the impact of the halving coming up?
Yeah. So, hey, we're different than most miners in that we own our own power assets and own our own data centers. So I think if you're, and we call that vertical integration. I think other miners will own their mining fleet, might own their data center, might not, but the vast majority, maybe only one or two others own their power assets. And so if that's your circumstance, like your revenue is about to be cut in half, because that's what the halving means. The reward will go from 900 coins a day down to 450. Maybe we'll see a decrease in the number of people competing for those rewards. So we could see an increase in hash rate related to that. We have an aside on hash rate in a moment. But it really means you have two choices. One is you can upgrade your fleet by buying more efficient machines to get more hash rate out of your existing power supply, or you can try to drive your cost structure down as low as you can by lowering your cost of power. So there aren't that many variables. So it's really just two, as I said. So what we're thinking about is both. We're both working on ways to upgrade our fleet to make it more efficient, to get more hash rate out of our existing plugs. And then we are working on a variety of ways to drive down our cost of power. So in our model, we are in PJM. We own two plants in PJM. Interestingly, PJM has among the cheapest power and for the next 2 years. So if the price of power is so low, which it is right now, that we can buy the power from the grid cheaper than we can make it, we'll shut our plants down and buy that power from the grid. In fact, it's cheaper than ERCOT for the next 2 years on average. So it's, you know, we are positioned to be one of the lowest cost miners just based on grid pricing. If the cost of power is high, like so high, we can shut down the data center and sell power to the grid. So last year, and I was quite proud of ourselves, we shut down the data center a few hundred times because the economic benefit to selling power to the grid was better than mining. And then everywhere in between, we generally will run the data centers and either have the plants running or not. So the ways we can drive the cost of power down in our space, one is we have a very interesting carbon capture project that we announced late last year. And that's really a result as a part of our process in making power, we are reclaiming waste that was left behind by hundreds of years of coal mining. It's the waste that was left on the surface is toxic. There are like 800 piles. I've talked about this on that last time we met. And it turns out that because we have to add crushed limestone to the fuel mix to take out the sulfur emissions, that creates an ash that is beneficial use ash. So you can use it as fertilizer. It's non-toxic. It has in it calcium oxide, which acts as a sponge in pulling carbon dioxide from the environment to create calcium oxide. So by weight, we can capture just slightly more than 10% by weight of carbon from the air. So if we make 100 pounds of ash, we can capture 10 pounds of carbon dioxide through direct air capture as a result of the carbon sponge properties of the ash. So the net result is we will end up with as we roll this project out, it's going to lower our net cost of power. And in the Bitcoin mining space, the only, you have Bitcoin price, you have hash price, and you have the cost of power. And that's really, and then you have the efficiency of your machines, and that will dictate what your margins will be. So we're pushing on, cheaper, lower emissions types of fuel. We're working on upgrading our fleet, and we're working on creative things like carbon capture, ultimately to lower our cost of power.
How do you think about capital allocators judging or kind of making a decision between, I have $1. I can go buy Bitcoin Direct. I can buy the ETFs. I can buy Coinbase or MicroStrategy and kind of like indirect exposure, levered exposure, or I can buy a miner. And it's like, what do you think are the pros and cons of miners in those comparisons?
Yeah, so a miner is going to have an outsized benefit from Bitcoin price running than buying in the spot market or buying Bitcoin directly. So we'll have a lot more margin expansion with a higher hash price. So just as a reminder for everyone, Bitcoin miners share the mining reward among the whole group, and we pool our hash rate and then get our pro rata share of the work that we contribute to the pool. And there's a big deal about the halving, but in reality, the amount of hash rate globally, that's increased 4 or 5 times since the last halving. So we are already sharing the rewards. They've been cut by a fourth or a fifth just by a lot more miners competing for those rewards. So the halving is yet another diminution in sort of the economics of mining, but it still works well because the hash price, the Bitcoin price has gone up enough to make it a worthwhile endeavor. But I think if you were to believe that, hey, if you buy Bitcoin on the belief that it's going to go up, you'll see a pretty dramatic margin expansion for the miners that should lead to an outsized gain in mining stocks versus what you just get from owning Bitcoin directly.
And when you begin to think about, there's the block subsidy, there's also transaction fees. And at times we've seen that become pretty meaningful. At other times it's been negligible. How do you think about transaction fees moving forward? And is that something that you can kind of model out and depend on as a business? Or is it more so that's like icing on the cake and hey, if fees spike, it's great to have, but we're not going to base our business on it?
Yeah, like looking backward, that's how we benefited from the spikes that occasionally happen. But on the future, it will have more halvings in it. And so I think we're going to be driven to more efficiency, but transaction fees will become a bigger percentage of the economic offering for the work related to mining. So I think it has to be considered more in the future. But looking backward, it's not something that I think most modeled in as a big contributor to margin.
Another topic that everyone seems to be very worried about or constantly talking about is the environmental impact of miners. And some of this is like, what power are you sucking in? Some of it is like, what are the emissions on the way out? And then a whole host of things that, my words, not yours, kind of made up concerns that frankly are just like a waste of everyone's time. But what do you think are maybe the environmental topics that are important? And you're like, hey, actually we spend time thinking about these and we do think that they're fair things for us to be held accountable to. And then how do you think about, maybe the areas where, look, everyone's talking about this stuff, but we don't see it actually playing out in reality.
Yeah, so I think first off, if you looked at the top, 5 or even 10 miners in the world, the projected growth rates of hash rate imply another 2.5 or 3 gigawatts of power need in the next like 18 months to 2 years, and that is a tremendous amount of power. And my view is it's improbable that all the predictions of all the miners come true and they'll be adding that hash rate, because it's a lengthy process to build data centers. It's a lengthy process to get things permitted and built. And I think Bitcoin miners are the best data center builders in the world, the fastest, the cheapest. And so I think we'll probably see a merge between those building these big data centers and Bitcoin miners at some point. I think we've seen it a little bit already. But that's part of the future. But I would sort of flip the answer a little bit by saying, hey, we as a country, we don't dictate the highest and if something's perceived to be bad for society, we don't say, well, hey, we're going to tax your power differently than we tax someone who's sort of good for society or deemed to be good for society. obviously, hey, those listening to your podcast probably believe that Bitcoin is good for the world and society. But, you know, hey, should we be taxing the power for data centers that run social media servers or distilleries or casinos? I think it's a dangerous thing to do to start to have the, you know, to have government judge who they say is good and bad and then charge a different rate for power. It's a free market system. And, you know, those that want to participate in buying power from the grid, that's a good thing. And I think that those that are making power have benefited from the build out of the demand from Bitcoin, have benefited from the continued build out in data centers that are, you know, that's one of the biggest growth businesses in the country now, is the build out of data centers, like unrelated to Bitcoin. But Bitcoin is different in that it's decentralized. So I think if you were to call Google and say, hey, Google, we want to build your data center, do you mind if it cycles off a few hundred times a year to benefit the stability of the power grid and to help suppress pricing in the grid? And they would say, no, I want to use the power regardless of price all the time, because, you know, my customers don't want to have intermittent service. Bitcoin miners can easily stomach intermittently turning off the data center. So, like, we turned off one of our data centers a few hundred times last year in response to high grid pricing. Texans, I think, do it even more often than that. You know, I was with one of my, you know, peer CEOs last week, and he said I bragged about 200 times. I said, hey, how about 1,000 times? And so the effect of cycling a data center, even, you know, you don't have to take it to dark, just put the miners in efficient mode, or put them in a sleep mode so they're not like rapidly cooling and degrading the equipment. The impact of that is the grid, even upon just a price response, will end up being much more stable if that grid has access to instantly, you know, 50 or 100 megawatts from a data center cycling down. And it's not talked about enough, but the impact of solar and wind, which are both intermittent sources of power, I'm for it. It's greening the planet. That's you know, it's heavily subsidized, but it's still, you know, a carbon-free source of electricity. To make the grid function like it functioned with a baseload fossil fuel, you need a grid scale battery, and grid scale batteries are dirty. They don't last long. They're dangerous because if they catch fire, how are you going to put that out? And they only last a couple hours. And so I think without thanks and even without any really recognition, Bitcoin miners are already acting like grid scale batteries. And the grid can't tell the difference. All the grid knows is, hey, we had a spike in the price, and all that within seconds, a lot more power became available. And that's what would happen with a battery. And that's what Bitcoin miners are doing. And it's stabilizing the grid. And that's to the benefit of society in the form of lower power prices, because we respond to those prices when we supply that power to the grid. And it also isn't talked about, like, a much bigger impact than Bitcoin mining on the price of power for consumers is the forcing of renewable energy onto the grid. It's not when people say, hey, solar's on par with like natural gas in terms of cost. Well, it's not, because it's not apples to apples. For you to recreate a 100 megawatt power plant in the solar world, you would need a giant battery and probably a gigawatt of power to feed the battery to run at night when the sun isn't shining. So, like, we've been fed a story that's apples and oranges, but I think the tell is that if you looked at the most renewable heavy grids in the world, they are also the most expensive power in the world. And that's just because you need effectively two grid. You need two sources of power. So you're doubling your base, and it results in in a more extensive power pricing. So like my answer is really, hey, we're already a solution for a problem that we have created by the introduction of these intermittent sources. So what Bitcoin mining can be an intermittent user and an intermittent curtailer. And I hope that that's how we can be viewed, because that's a way to prevent, you know, we're going to get more brownouts and blackouts the more solar and wind you add. And so I think you really ought, you want to have Bitcoin mines in those areas where you have a lot of solar and wind. It'll help stabilize the marketplace.
Another aspect is carbon and being carbon negative. Talk a little bit about how you all see kind of the environmental component around carbon kind of ingestion.
Yeah, so I think we clean up waste piles. So here's what happened. So before 1975, coal miners could, they would mine the coal, bring it up from beneath the surface. The good coal, they would take and turn it into power or use it to make steel. And the marginal quality stuff, which is about 30 or 40% of what came out beneath the surface, was left on the surface. And that is highly pollutive. It's heavy in sulfur, you know, mercury, all the truly cancer causing stuff, is left on the surface. That is causing a massive amount of groundwater and pollution in Pennsylvania, which is our biggest sort of coal mining state. And there is no, you know, the youngest of these piles is about 50 years old now. So there is no other solution to clean them up. If you leave them as they are, the methane emissions, which are, you know, methane emissions are multiples of carbon in terms of greenhouse gas effect. It's, you know, up to 50 times more impactful than carbon when released into the air. So leaving them on the surface is a greenhouse gas plus, like, of the 800 piles, maybe more than 50 of them are on fire right now. So they're burning, you know, without emissions control. So we are carbon negative versus leaving the piles in their current state as they are. So we go in with, you know, we partner with the Pennsylvania DEP to identify these sites. We get grants to clean them up. We earn renewable energy credits to, you know, when we create the power as a part of the benefit to clean up the piles, we get that. And so, yeah, our carbon negative role is really just a result of the waste that we're cleaning up being so bad that it still makes sense to burn it with emissions controls than it does to leave it on the surface. And that's not including the benefit to the communities when they, you know, right now, you know, you'll go to a neighborhood and they'll have a, you know, a row of houses backing up to a, you know, 100-acre waste site. It's just, it's not a, it's not kind. The mine is gone, the companies are gone, and the state is left to clean up the mess. And so that's really what we are tasked with doing. And we have a purpose-built facility. This is not a thermal coal plant, the things that we run. These are purpose-built plants specifically designed to clean up this legacy problem. And we've got like another 15 or 20 years left and all the stuff will be cleaned up. So, you know, if we end up, you know, not doing it, I think this waste will be here and the water pollution, air pollution will be here for another, you know, 500 years. It's just, there's no other way to do it.
Do you guys get incentivized to do the cleanup, or is it pretty much, there's like a market force that incentivizes you by it's cheaper or more efficient or something?
Yeah. So the market force is we sell the power into the market or use it to convert to Bitcoin. We get renewable energy credits, which is a market-based system that Pennsylvania set up, but that's still a system that if government didn't create the system, then they wouldn't get that benefit. Then we get a small benefit just on per ton for cleaning up the waste. But I'd say, hey, the big benefit is just to the communities. Like, I think you can go to our website, you'll see the before and after pictures. And you sort of, you know, they're ashamed that this country industrialized and left what we left behind. So it's important that we clean up the mess.
Now, talk a little bit about kind of Bitcoin and the amount of Bitcoin you're able to mine based on the current hardware. And it seems like every couple of years, hardware and machines and even the software that, you know, it's going to run, we get these like efficiency and innovative gains.
Yep.
Should we expect that to continue? Is there some sort of like mental model you all use when thinking about, you know, hey, here's the fleet we have today. How often are we going to have to replace this? What does that cost look like? Just how do you kind of think of cap allocation when it comes to the hardware and the fleet?
That's a great question. So right now we're running about 4 exahash. If we were to replace our fleet with brand new machines that are the most efficient, that have a higher hash rate per, you know, power used, we could be at 7 exahash. So that's sort of our potential in today's terms. And of course, I think I would expect efficiency gains to continue as long as mining stays an economic business like it is today. And as I said, hey, the other way to make the same money is to just drive your costs down. So like if there's a surprise coming to the market, it's if you looked at where mining is likely to go, it's in my view, it's likely to go in jurisdictions where power is cheap, you know, energy is abundant, and jurisdictions where people are looking to get out of dollar dominance, that would be a popular thing to do. So like, hey, well, we're going to find out that Russia has been mining and growing their mining activity. I would be surprised if the answer is no. You know, I think they're, I hear like China has quietly, you know, started to add mining again, even though it's banned. The Middle East, I think it's known publicly that they're growing, you know, mining activities, and that's not a, we should not be surprised by any of those. So I think it's a, I would expect, you know, global hash rate to continue to grow, including in places outside the US.
Now, when you look at those places, are there geopolitical concerns, or should we want competition? And I go back to at one point, China had, you know, 60% of hash rate. I think people are like, it's China, they have 60%. We don't like that. They kind of self-inflicted wound, a bunch of people unplugged the machines. Now the US has, you know, upwards of 30-35+%, 10% in Texas. Like, could the US have too much hash rate? You know, if we got to 50 or 60% in the US, would that be concerning? And how do you just think maybe about the geographic both competition and also, you know, partnership of a distributed or decentralized system not being too concentrated anywhere?
Yeah. So hey, it's obviously it's important that it stay decentralized. That's part that is the, you know, the key to the attractiveness of Bitcoin is it is the largest decentralized network in the world. As much as we all criticize sort of the US, we still have the best capital markets in the world. We still have rule of law here. And even if it in New York, it occasionally takes a detour. But I don't think that a concentration of mining in the US would constitute a threat to the network. So I would not be, you know, in spite of what, you know, the occasional letter from senators that we all get, I don't predict a ban on mining here, there is no like imminent tax that would cause mining to be unattractive in the US. And I don't think that would change. But I think it is because it's a truly global store of value, and we want to see, you know, I'd like to see activity of use in Bitcoin and, or, you know, around the world. I think it's good for adoption, good for awareness. And I think you can also benefit other power grids. I saw a preview of a movie called Dirty Coin. I don't know if you've seen that one yet. They're mining in Africa and using the sort of excess power at night is what's subsidizing like microgrids for African communities that wouldn't get access to that power otherwise. That's a relatively small component, but you obviously have heard about you know, stranded gas being converted to Bitcoin, or being converted to electricity than Bitcoin. So that's a global thing. So I'm for a global product, global awareness, global utilization. And I think it's generally good for the ecosystem.
And then what are the areas that maybe people are not talking about in mining, but you think are really important? They could be internal operations. They could be, you know, how these companies are being funded today, or it could even just be like market developments over the next 12 months that, you know, you want to wave a flag and say, hey, everyone pay attention to this, even though you're not yet.
Yeah. So obviously it's the allocation of capital question. It's I think there probably isn't quite enough transparency with the public market as to, hey, is it a good investment to buy a new machine? Or is it better to have the old one run with lower margin? Like, what's the real return on capital that we have that we can achieve in this business? I guess going back to the predictions for what people are expected to grow in the next couple of years, you know, to add almost 3 gigawatts of power. That's going to take, you know, it's a $5 to $10 billion investment for the industry to grow as it's projecting it's going to grow. And that's between power, data centers, new machines. And I guess what I'd like to see, you know, for all of us miners is just the proof that, hey, this is a good return on capital. Does it make sense to use, you know, internally generated cash flow to buy those machines, or should you issue more stock to buy the machine? Should you issue debt? Like, what's the best way to grow? I think a few guys are sort of growing for growth's sake and being silent on whether or not this is a positive return on invested capital. And so I think that's what I would hope to see is, hey, just the discipline. Capital can be scarce. And I think, you know, discipline and transparency is what I would hope we can see.
Talk a little bit about tokenization, which I know is something that you've thought about. AI took the, you know, kind of center stage after crypto had 2020, 2021. AI kind of got 2022, 2023. But you think that Bitcoin plus some of the work that's going on in tokenization could potentially bring back the spotlight?
You know what? That's right. I thought that, and then BlackRock had yet another announcement on sort of a tokenization fund, and like we're going to see like the low hanging fruits. Like, hey, who doesn't want to buy a minority share of a sports team? Like, you know, sports fans. That's easy. Who doesn't want to buy a tokenized portfolio of real estate or aviation leases? Like any financial project that can be securitized, can be tokenized. But like even beyond that, my first job was at Goldman Sachs in 1993. And the big theme of that, like the annual employee get together, was derivatives. That's what, you know, all the bankers said, hey, here's what a derivative is. And your clients may not know that they need it, but, you know, if they want to hedge a certain risk, they can. Goldman could then create a new product for just that client, and will sell, you know, break out the risk and sell to a different client. And Goldman being in the middle could create a new market. I really view tokenization as the next step in how to make derivatives available while really shrinking the role of the middleman. And so like these examples, that would be like, I think the first insurance company to say, hey, I want to go underwrite here's a basket of insurance risks, and I want to sell that to the public or to other investors, tokenize it. Because you can then, you know, the insurance company will say, hey, here's the product. They'll essentially be they would have been the underwriter. They can make their fee for underwriting, but the insurance company doesn't even need to own that risk anymore. They can tokenize it and share it, and there can be a return for that. So I think we're going to see like the low-hanging fruit of things that can be securitized to be easily tokenized. But I'm actually more excited about the coming change to, you know, what I think will be almost every industry for what it can mean to get access to less friction once you do a deal underwriting, which I would say is just next generation derivative transactions without the middleman. That's what I think, you know, and that'll be a 20-year benefit to and evolution of the, you know, fintech. So I think it's, yeah, as you, I'm sort of disappointed to say, hey, we sort of, crypto had its moment in the sun for about, you know, an hour and a half, but it's far from, like, that excitement is not misplaced. It's still going to show up in industry.
The beauty of Bitcoin is that it was adopted by individuals first, then kind of, you know, financial organizations, corporations, eventually nation states. Do you think tokenization follows the same path, or is it more top down where you need the financial organizations to do things that either are more, you know, kind of financial or they are more regulated?
You know, the easy way is would have to be top down. Right. So and I think there'll be margin for the first mover. But hey, once the first mover happens, like in insurance, in my example, everyone else is going to be required to do the same thing because it's going to impact cost of capital. And that insurance is a cost of capital business. And so I think we'll have in this instance, which I know is different than you know, traditional crypto. It can be easily dominated by incumbents that I think will find a good reason to enhance margins for doing this. It's just a, you know, when the first guy goes in the industry, it'll be a race.
And then when you think of your company and kind of the team and how you all are positioned, when you talk to folks, like what are the things that you think give you an advantage in the market or you say, hey, look, this is where we really think we've got like this wedge or advantage and we're going to try to exploit this throughout this bull market?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So hey, we're the only vertically integrated one of scale. And so hey, we're right now at one plant, we have it idled while we're buying power from the grid because power is so cheap. The other plant, we're making power cheaper than we can buy it. So we're, you know, we have that arbitrage to make. So I think we're the most effective power pricing arbitrage vehicle of the miners. That makes us different. I think we have, unfortunately, I think the market has really just valued, you know, scale and growth rate more than that ability. So I think we have not benefited from a stock price standpoint like we think we should have. I think people don't really understand our asset or our model as well as we'd love them to. But I think as a market, hey, there are more than 20 publicly traded Bitcoin miners today. And my expectation is that post-halving, we're going to see consolidation. So it's a you'll have those, you know, being public is an expensive way to go, you know, as an enterprise. So to the extent you can see consolidation and synergies between companies, I think I would expect to see that this year.
And then if we look back, I don't know, maybe in 3 to 5 years, and you guys execute how you plan to execute, what is that look like in terms of market dynamics? Is there a lot of consolidation in the industry and you guys would eventually look to kind of buy up other firms as part of that consolidation? Maybe you don't think there'll be consolidation, like you know, you get credit and we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. You're gonna do everything you say you guys are gonna do and your roadmap and everything executes perfectly. How do you interact with the rest of the market?
Yeah, so if we execute well, we're gonna drive our cost of power to a super low point where it'll be clear that even with less efficient machines, that we'll end up with a better margins than what's possible elsewhere without having to constantly reinvest new capital in more efficient machines. So that's the best thing we can do is drive our cost of power down. Which we have a carbon capture project we're doing to do that. As I said, we're working on new fuels that can also have that same impact. And so I think that's our best way to execute, which is different than others, is we have the ability and levers to drive our cost of power down. given that we make it ourselves. So that would be an achievement. And with that, hey, we probably will continue to upgrade the fleet. I think it just makes sense to push on that front as well.
Got it. Where can we send people to find out more about you, about Stronghold, and what you guys are doing?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn, Greg Beard, and Stronghold Digital Mining has a website that has a bunch of great case studies and all of our public information as well. So yeah, please have a look.
The one thing I will say is if people go to the website, the videos are pretty cool in terms of the communities. I think they're, if I remember correctly, there's one where it's like a reclaimed site and there's been soccer, football fields and baseball fields. And then there's some that are, it appears like the vegetation is growing back, all this stuff. And so pretty cool to kind of hear what you guys are doing and the thought process, but then actually see it visually in photos. I remember saying, wow, that's pretty just awesome to see that happening in a community.
No, thanks. Now it's thousands of acres cleaned up. So I'm really proud of we're really a reclamation business coupled to a Bitcoin mining business. And, both are very important activities for us.
Awesome. Well, Greg, thank you so much.
Congratulations to your big announcement today. I'll be looking forward to, more of your thoughts and what you come up with on a daily basis. So thank you.
I appreciate it very much. We'll definitely do this again in the future.
Yep, you bet. Thank you.